Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for listening to Here and Now. If you love this show, then you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our show going and helps NPR create new ones. The best way to keep Here and Now and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give and then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. Thanks.
Let's start the hour with where we are on the Senate tax plan. Last night, it passed out of the Budget Committee along a 12-11 party line vote. The Senate may vote as soon as tomorrow. So who came out with the change they wanted? Who's still waiting? Kelsey Snell is congressional reporter for NPR on Capitol Hill. And Kelsey, yesterday you talked about this trigger that would raise taxes back if the cuts proposed raise the deficit too much. Who wanted that? Did they get it?
Yeah. Yesterday, this was the big talk of the Capitol. And the senators I talked to last night and today definitely sound more confident about this bill, in part because it seems like there is an agreement to add this trigger in as an amendment, something that was asked for by Senators Jeff Flake of Arizona and Bob Corker of Tennessee. And basically, like you said, it would automatically increase taxes if the economy doesn't grow as much as expected. So the idea is it would be added as an amendment early in the voting process, yeah, which could start as early as today.
But even Susan Collins, who was skeptical about the way the plan would raise the deficit, said she was told, you know, last night that she would have amendments. A lot of the deal making was premised on that, the assumption that there'd be this conference when the bill passes so senators could get these concessions. Is there a sense that that's definitely going to happen?
Sure. When I spoke to Collins yesterday, she said that she had a very strong reason to believe. She was given the impression that this conference will definitely happen. But it's important to remember that this is being done as part of the budget process. And the budget process is kind of this freewheeling way of allowing tons of almost unlimited amendments. Mm-hmm. So over the next couple of days, so long as they can start voting on this tax bill, just about everybody in the Senate will have a chance to try to amend this legislation before it comes for a final vote.
Okay. Well, another big question was bigger tax cuts for these so-called pass-through businesses. These are, you know, medium and sometimes very large companies whose profits pass through to the owners who have to file for them under individual tax rates, often ultimately higher than the corporate rates. As we said yesterday, 70% of these pass-through, the pass-through income is going to the top 1% of the income earners in America. But Ron Johnson of Wisconsin really wanted lower rates. Did he get that?
Well, what Johnson and a couple of other senators were asking for was to cut the rate from 25% as proposed in the bill right now down to 20%, which is where they would set the corporate rate. We don't know for sure if he got that. It's still being discussed. But what we do know is that Johnson was satisfied enough that he was one of those people on the budget committee who voted for the bill, voted to move the bill out of committee and out to the floor. So we should find out in the next couple of hours if he did get that, yeah, that piece he was asking for.
Okay. In the minute we have, there's a closely watched report coming out as soon as tonight from the Joint Committee on Taxation on what this bill would add to the debt. What's the sense of how that will impact the vote?
Well, it actually impacts whether or not it can even get a vote. So we are expecting to see not just if it adds to the deficit in 10 years, but in the years out in the future. It probably won't convince a lot of Republicans to vote for or against this bill, but it's an important data point as the debate goes forward.
Right, because they can't go above a certain amount of money, I think $1.3 trillion or something. $1.5 trillion, in order to vote the way they want. So everybody's watching that vote. We'll keep that report coming out. We'll keep an eye on it as well. Kelsey Snell, congressional reporter for NPR from the Capitol. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, joining us now is Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican from South Dakota. Senator, do you think at this point that Republicans have the votes they need to pass the tax bill?
I think it'd be fair to say that there is a broad agreement that we all have to get to yes. I think there are still a number of members who have issues that they'd like to try to resolve. It's kind of like saying, look, I know in the end we want to make some pretty good sausage here, but there's maybe a few more spices that some would like to add in or take from. When it's all said and done, I think we'll have at least 50, if not 51, or maybe even 52 votes in favor of the proposal.
Are there any things that you need right now to get to yes?
No, I'm going to vote for the product, but I will also tell you that I think we could make it better. And as the other folks continue to negotiate, there's a desire on the part of some members to talk about a kind of a trigger mechanism or something that would bring back in additional revenues through rate changes.
This would basically be if the bill doesn't produce the results that are being promised, that taxes would automatically go back up.
Yeah, and that's one of the alternatives out there that's having a lot of discussion right now in terms of how do you do that without throwing cold water on the desires of a lot of businesses to have some stability to their planning. And one of the ways that you take care of that is by having a pretty low threshold for what your goal is in terms of a GDP improvement. We're talking GDP improvement of literally about less than one-half of 1% due to this as being able to pay for the rate changes that we've incorporated in the plan. Honestly, there's a lot of us that think that we're going to easily exceed that because even today, just with the promise of these changes, we're already closing in on an average of 3% GDP, which is more than double what we need in terms of the change from the previous 8 years. So we think we're in pretty good shape, but we'll listen to those individuals and we'll try to address their concerns.
What about the issue of health care? This bill would eliminate the penalty for not buying health insurance, the so-called individual mandate set up in the Affordable Care Act. Analysts have looked at this and they said it would cause premiums to rise. 13 million people would lose their health care. Are you worried about that?
I am not. First of all, the individuals who are paying that, 80% of them are with family incomes of less than $50,000 a year. Second of all, this does not stop anybody from getting insurance. All of the benefits and additional subsidies and so forth are still included. So this is based upon a projection that says if they're not going to make them buy it, that would mean that those healthy individuals would not be adding healthy premium dollars, which they said could increase premiums by 10%. However, as an offset to that, we have a proposal, the Alexander Murray Plan, which we believe will actually reduce the costs of health care that are for the next 2 years in a transition period up to 20%. And that has bipartisan support, Republicans and Democrats. And
would you vote on that before the tax cut package, though?
Probably what would happen, and this is only my estimate, once again, I don't get to make this decision, but I would envision the possibility of passing the tax proposal out of the Senate first, then addressing the Alexander Murray, and waiting for the conference committee to come back, having already passed out the Alexander Murray. Now, yesterday we got a real boost because the president made it very clear to us in our closed-door meeting. He basically told the group it's okay to vote for that bipartisan measure. That was a real good thing to have happen, and it'll make it a lot easier to get that through the House because that's the transition for many of us into the total repeal and replacement of Obamacare and back to a kind of a block grant approach that you found within the Graham-Cassidy proposal that was being discussed in the Senate for about a month before we moved on to taxes. I really think long-term that's the plan that will be the repeal and replacement of Obamacare.
One more thing, Senator. We spoke yesterday with your colleague, Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, and he said that this tax bill would squeeze the middle class to benefit the rich. Let's listen.
It's where Republicans always go when they meet in their special interest groups in the back room. That's why the middle class continues to shrink in this country. That's why the rich are getting richer, and this will just accelerate that trend. We all know that in this body. Some don't want to recognize it because they do the bidding of their billionaire contributors far too often.
What's your response to that?
I think that's probably an inappropriate message. I would really disagree with the analysis that he's used. I normally don't try to place the reasoning that someone uses. I do try to look at what the outcomes are, and we want to build a healthy economy. We know that if businesses aren't seen as being competitive here, they'll go someplace else because they can. And so we are trying to help businesses by giving them a reduced tax rate, but we're also doing some really good things for families. And we think not only would the reduction in taxes help where people could actually use it to their benefit based on where they want to see it spent, but we also think and improving economy is good for them as well, to the tune of probably an additional $2,000 in income per year at the minimum.
So, and you're not satisfied with 3.3% GDP growth, which you cited earlier that we just found out. I mean, is that not good enough?
No, what we're thinking is this. We think that the 1.4, 1.5, 1.6 that's been going on for the last 8 years anyway, we know that that is not enough to take care of the needs of our country. What we know right now is that we're going to probably come in on an average of 3%, but we believe that a lot of that is based upon the anticipation that we really are going to do something with regard to tax reform. We think this is just the first step, but it's a major step. After that, as the president talked with us yesterday, we're going to look at an infrastructure bill. We're going to look at one because we need infrastructure repair and improvements so that we can be more effective as a country in delivering GDP. And it's also a good way to keep people working as well to benefit future generations.
That's Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican from South Dakota. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to visiting with you again.
The news of Matt Lauer's firing on the Today Show today launched a Twitter storm. President Trump, who admitted after that Access Hollywood tape that he did the things he said on the tape, like grab women, tweeted out that NBC should now take on its fake news. Well, Lauer's Today Show co-host Savannah Guthrie was obviously shaken.
Just moments ago, NBC News Chairman Andy Lack sent the following note to our organization. Dear colleagues, on Monday night, we received a detailed complaint from a colleague about inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace by Matt Lauer. It represented, after serious review, a clear violation of our company's standards. As a result, we have decided to terminate his employment. While it is the first complaint about his behavior in the over 20 years he has been at NBC News, we were also presented with reason to believe this may not have been an isolated incident.
Matt Lauer has hosted Today since 1997, was a powerful engine for the network, but now he joins Fox News' Bill O'Reilly, ABC News' Mark Halperin, NPR's Mike Oreskes, Charlie Rose of CBS, and others making an exit. There have been reports that NBC's hand was forced by forthcoming investigations from the New York Times and Variety. Variety reporter Elizabeth Wagmeister tweeted this morning, "There are multiple women we've spoken to with far-ranging accusations against Lauer. The power of journalism has never been more evident with this cultural change." Well, Variety's senior TV critic Brian Steinberg joins us now. And Brian, she says far-ranging accusations. Now, Variety hasn't published yet, but that can range from sexual harassment to assault. What can you tell us?
Well, I think if you look at NBC's statement from this morning, they said they got a complaint earlier this week from someone and they felt the incident was not may not be an isolated one. There's clearly some larger pattern of behavior, it sounds like, according to NBC's statement. And I would let what Elizabeth said on Twitter this morning speak for itself.
Yeah. Well, Yasher Ali of Huffington Post has also been tweeting. I and other reporters have been aware of several women who have come forward privately in the past few months. This was even before Weinstein, and they didn't want to go public. They were terrified of Matt. So people are now who have been doing this reporting coming forward. But you mentioned that someone came to NBC on Monday. This is according to NBC chair Andrew Lack's statement. But then Brian Stelter of CNN is reporting that NBC brass has known for weeks that these damaging reports were coming. Did Variety speak to them and alert them that these reports were coming?
You're putting me in a position where I'm commenting on a colleague's
right.
story that hasn't been published yet, so I'm reluctant. You wouldn't ask an NPR journalist to do the same thing, so I have to kind of just take a stand here. I'm sorry.
Oh, I probably would, but they would probably say the same thing. You're right. Because this,
I appreciate it.
No, because she hasn't finished her reporting.
Yeah.
But, you know, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect there. There seems to be reporting that, you know, NBC knew that these reports were coming. And, of course, they say that a woman came forward just on Monday. So there's a bit of a shock. What was Matt Lauer's role at NBC?
Look, Matt Lauer has presided over one of the most stable and lucrative franchises in television. The Today Show brings in millions of dollars in advertising revenue every year. The first of the format, it was around before Good Morning America was. It has defined NBC from Dave Garraway and his chimpanzee all the way through Matt and Savannah today. Mm. It is an institution. It is part of American culture. Mm. And, you know, these hosts become part of the family.
Well, and I should, full disclosure, it's a very, very small chapter in Today Show history, but big in mind, I was a substitute host for Jane Pauley for many years. It
yes.
is a beloved place. And you say stable. We remember there was another incident where Ann Curry, one of the hosts, was seemingly forced out of her role. So there has been eruptions. But how does a network scramble? Their hosts were shaken. Their reputation is at stake. What do you think happens, and especially when this reporting comes out?
Well, it's fascinating. You have two shows right now in the middle of this very strange and surreal episode. CBS This Morning also reeling from Charlie Rose's revelations last week. As pleasant as these programs are, there is a scorched earth battle for ratings between Good Morning America and Today on CBS This Morning and all the cable shows, Morning Joe and New Day on CNN and even Fox and Friends. There's a frenzy for viewership, and any shift in an anchor lineup can mean a shift in audience.
Not to mention the lives that are affected. His family, the women, so a lot of collateral damage. But just give me what are we talking about money-wise here, Brian?
I believe the last report for Lauer was $20 million a year. That's not unusual. We believe that, you know, Robin Roberts, George Stephanopoulos make between 10 and 20 as well.
And how much do they bring in?
They bring in several hundred million dollars worth of revenue every year in ad revenue.
Yeah.
They are big profit centers. The money they bring in helps fund the rest of NBC News' efforts.
Boy. That's Variety senior TV critic Brian Steinberg. We're awaiting Variety reporter Elizabeth Wagmeister's investigation, ongoing investigation of former Today Show host Matt Lauer. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to a report from the CDC that more than 64,000 people died from drug overdoses in 2016. 64,000. And here's another fact from data in just one state, Massachusetts. People who overdose on heroin or fentanyl are up to 30 times more likely to die if they're homeless. The findings, no surprise to drug users who live on the streets or in the woods. Martha Biebinger from member station WBUR discovered that on a visit to an urban tent community just outside Boston.
A network of 10 or so tents sits off a paved trail near bustling shops and restaurants just outside Boston. One side of the walking, biking path is lined with luxury condos. On the other side, ducks paddle across a pond into fields of cattails.
It's this beautiful marshy area. There's wildflowers, a bird sanctuary, lily pads.
Kristen, a homeless drug user, guides me past the marsh.
And then when you get into like the thicker wood parts and you see paths,
more than a dozen, some pounded down by deer, underage drinkers or hikers, and some that lead to campsites.
That's where you have these little tent communities of homeless addicts. Just to see the two existing, like, together is bizarre.
Bizarre and confusing. Kristen scrambled down the wrong path twice, looking for the tent where she left a bag and some bedding.
No, it's up a little further, sorry. I haven't been here in like a week and a half, 2 weeks maybe.
Kristen says she was detained by police on outstanding warrants and then hospitalized for an infected injection wound in one arm. We're only using first names in this story because Kristen and other tent dwellers use illegal drugs. I slip down a bank, walk a plank across some mud, and up a short hill to a cluster of three tents. Kristen pokes her head into a maroon and gray one, the last place she called home.
It's just like a messed up shooting gallery in there.
Kristen sees her clothes and bedding, but doesn't pull them out.
It's all in there trashed, covered in like mysterious liquid, dirt, pipe tobacco, broken needles. It's bad.
It's hard to tell what happened here, but looking around, Kristen sees signs of methamphetamine users who go into overdrive and stay up for days on end. Not the heroin users like herself, who tend to be more mellow.
One of the side effects or behaviors, I don't know what you want to call it, of methamphetamine use is hoarding stuff. Candles, throw pillows.
A few feet away, there's a microwave oven, a George Foreman grill, and a waffle maker.
What the heck is a waffle maker doing out here?
Joking aside, Kristen says this is not a clean or safe place to inject drugs.
You're even just walking through here, your arms are getting dirty. They doubt you're going to use an alcohol wipe. You know, say someone comes and wants to shoot heroin and they see that spoon that was like in the mulch in the dirt. They're probably just going to give that a quick little wipe, if that.
Some users avoid shooting up in the woods. Take Joe, who comes out of a large red tent near a creek, a space he's been sharing for about 4 months.
My friends have been here longer, but I'm tent sitting.
Yeah, like house sitting, kind of.
Protecting clothes, money, and personal items. Holding down the rights to this flat spot near water, well out of sight from the paved path. Joe says he hasn't used heroin since the morning last February, when he and a buddy went to a porta potty near a busy intersection and Joe overdosed. The friend called 911.
They hit me four times with Narcan and the paddles. I was dead, deader than dead.
And Joe might still be dead if he'd overdosed in his tent.
How would police or EMTs ever find you if you were in trouble? It's definitely like playing roulette out here.
Kristen and Joe say they've never seen a police officer, EMT, or park ranger in these woods. But a few weeks after this interview, someone pitches a tent too close to the bike path and is spotted. Officers sweep the area, pushing the tent community deeper into the woods. With heavy bush clippers, a man named Bobby clears dead vines from inside a thicket, creating enough space for a tent that will be concealed by brush.
Right. Now look at that. That's great. And that's
Bobby and his boyfriend Eddie have been in these woods on and off for a year and know the risks. Bobby says he OD'd last winter. Eddie used four pumps of naloxone, all he had on hand, to revive Bobby.
That's scary. It was dark out. We had no phone. So and it was the middle of the night. So imagine, no one to call, no way to call anybody, no one to contact.
So why is this better than a shelter?
You can come and go as we want, and we feel safe. It's ours.
In a shelter, Eddie says, people take your stuff. They spread head lice, and they deal drugs.
Shelters are not the place to be if you're trying to stay clean. That's just the reality.
Eddie and Bobby say they're on methadone now and haven't used heroin or fentanyl for several weeks. Their main concern right now is preparing the new tent site.
Push this off.
In a dumpster near the bike path, Bobby spots thick laminated doors, luxury condo leftovers.
We get two of those under the tent.
They keep you off the ground. You're good to go.
Bobby pushes aside a box of chrome door pulls.
Yeah, we don't want those.
Those are nice door handles.
They really are, but we don't have any doors for them.
Bobby and Eddie still stock their tent with naloxone, hoping to have enough in case one of them overdoses again, hoping they don't both go out at once, hoping they beat the odds of using drugs while homeless. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
YouTube says it has taken down more than 150,000 videos and canceled more than 270 accounts after it discovered that child predators had been targeting content on the site. It's just the latest in a series of actions the company has taken to combat the use of YouTube by pedophiles. And it comes after several advertisers, including Adidas, Deutsche Bank, and Hewlett-Packard, suspended their ads on YouTube after they were paired with abusive content. We're joined now by Here and Now media analyst John Carroll, a mass communications professor at Boston University. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what do we mean when we say that child predators are targeting content on YouTube?
Well, these are mostly videos uploaded by kids. And you know, in one way, they're kind of innocent videos. In another way, looked at it from another angle, they are videos that can show kids in threatened positions or compromising situations, you know, rolling around on a bed, something like that. And they're attracting these sexually inappropriate comments in a pretty significant way.
So what is YouTube doing about it?
Well, first of all, you need to understand 400 hours of video is uploaded to YouTube every minute.
Right.
So they're never going to get totally out in front of this. But what they have done is go and turn off comments for 670,000 videos. They've removed ads from about 2 million videos. What they're trying to do is find as much of this inappropriate content as they can and basically eliminate it.
And the ads would show up probably before you watch the video, like they do when you watch almost anything on YouTube at this point. But this is not the first time that this has happened, that ads have been running with content that is offensive or abusive to children. Why hasn't YouTube been able to stop it up until this point?
Part of the problem is these ads are placed by algorithm. They're not placed by people. So a lot of times the advertiser doesn't even know what content that their ads are being attached to. So back in March, there was a advertiser boycott over ads attached to terrorist videos and hate speech. This one, they have a number of advertisers, but it's really not the money. It's not that much money. Adidas spends $8 million. Mars spends $7 million. This is a PR problem for YouTube, and that's the bigger problem, is if it discourages people from placing their ads on YouTube. You know, it's one thing to pull them off. It's another thing to never place them there.
Well, right. Is it too risky for a company to even bother placing ads online when they don't have control over what it's going to be linked to?
You know, the problem is, you know, advertisers want to fish where the fishes are. And YouTube, there's a billion videos viewed every day on YouTube. So there's a big market there. And this happens, and this is sort of now part of the price of admission for going online. We've seen this happen with Breitbart News. A lot of advertisers didn't even know they were running ads on Breitbart News. You know, they're alerted to it, and then they take them off. But that's the way the process works. There's just too much content out there, and there are too many algorithms placing the ads for the marketers to really know exactly where all their ads are.
So is YouTube saying anything about how it plans to address this going forward?
Sure. They posted a notice on their blog saying basically they're going to have tougher enforcement of the guidelines. They're going to have faster enforcement. They're going to block inappropriate comments. You know, they're saying all the right things, the things they would normally say. But again, you know, it's going to be very hard for them to get out in front of this in totality.
That's John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst. John, thank you.
Thank you.
We love language. We love words, how we use them. You let us know when we abuse them. But even we who love words wept and were overwhelmed by the new book from former BuzzFeed Global Copy editor Emmy Favilla, because she loves words more than we do, and it's almost too much. Emmy got a lot of buzz when her style guide for BuzzFeed's writers went public in 2014. It was called The Unofficial Style Guide for the Internet. Now Emmy expands those thoughts in the new book, A World Without Whom, The Essential Guide to Language in the BuzzFeed Age. Have you heard millennials use the word adulting, as in, I'm paying the bills, working 9 to 5, adulting? Emmy joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my gosh. I'm just overwhelmed. When to do the apostrophe, when to do the hyphen. It doesn't stop. But you say right at the beginning, this is about feelings, not rules, because how can anyone in good conscience create blanket rules for something as fluid, as personal, and as alive as language? But then you tell us, personal pronouns never take apostrophe. So it's hers, never her apostrophe s. That would be her is. Effect means have an effect on. Effect means make something like change happen. So there are rules.
There are rules. I think that the number of hard and fast rules is dwindling a bit. It's funny to me how everything else in our world evolves, technology, the food we eat, our fashion, but for whatever reason, language is this one thing that people are such sticklers about.
Well, trust us, you're talking about the language police, and we hear from them. It sounds like your basic point is you want to be understood and you want to be clear. So you have to know that discrete, D-I-S-C-R-E-T-E, means distinct, but discrete, D-I-S-C-R-E-E-T, means unobtrusive. You know, you want to use the right words.
Absolutely. Sometimes that means that we can use words that aren't, quote unquote, real words, words that aren't in the dictionary, like adulting.
Right. Well, and just I'm open to your pop quiz. You want to give another example?
Another example of words that are often misspelled are hoards. So a hoard, H-O-A-R-D, mm-hmm. is a large collection of something, while a hoard, H-O-R-D-E, is a large group of people. Uh-huh. And as a copy editor, I feel like this is one of the top spelling mistakes that I see, even from professional journalists and writers. And to be quite honest, sometimes I have to double check, too, because after looking at words on a screen all day long, sometimes I kind of feel like my brain is deteriorating a little bit. And I'm like, oh, wait, is that the spelling that means this?
I love metal, and metal.
Oh,
there's all four
one.
Of them. Yeah. So a medal with a D is what you get for achievement. Medal with two Ds, M-E-D-D-L-E, to interfere. Metal, the substance. And metal with two Ts, strength of spirit. I think people can be forgiven for mixing up their metal with two Ts and their medal with two Ds.
Oh, I'm sure that I have as well.
One of our favorite chapters is How Not to Be a Jerk, writing about sensitive topics. You point out we've become more aware of inclusive language, so avoid committed suicide and took one's life, because to some, committed carries a sort of criminal or negative connotation. What are some of the other ways you've had to rethink language to be sensitive?
Well, one of the big things that we as editors at BuzzFeed that we come across a lot is talking about people with diseases or disabilities or dealing with some kind of ailment or condition. And person-first language is really important. Person-first language meaning that you put the person before you put their disease or their condition, because ultimately we're talking about a human and we're not talking about a disease that has, you know, overtaken a person. Mm-hmm. And so what that means in practice is that you would say she has cancer. Rather than saying she is a cancer victim, you also want to avoid phrases that may connote pity and a sense that a person is in this position of powerlessness. She is a wheelchair user rather than being confined to a wheelchair, which has that same sort of connotation.
Well, the one that always comes to us, I don't see it here, but it's the same thinking, person with autism rather than an autistic.
It's really interesting because we were actually approached by various activists and people who represented organizations for autistic people, and they actually asked us to refer to autistic people as that because autism is such an integral part of their identity in the same way that being a deaf person is. You wouldn't really ever find yourself saying a person with deafness. You would say, you know, he or she or they are a deaf person.
Well, you just said something interesting. You said he, she, they. They has really become popular.
Oh, it sure has. I am a very big proponent of the singular epicene they. First of all, let's all be honest with ourselves. It's the way that we actually talk. We'll say something like, well, if a person is doing X, they should do Y. And then, of course, you know, it makes room for multiple genders, for people who don't identify as male or female. And it just makes for smoother prose when you can avoid the alternative he/she or S in brackets
right
he or S/HE or whatever the alternative that's not only an eyesore but just sort of awkward to say in speech. And so they is a lifesaver.
And increasingly, you may not be sure, you know, because people are gender fluid. Look, I want to you've got the chapter How Social Media Has Changed the Game. There's like three pages on the 42 ways to type laughter on social media. This is from your colleague, Katie Heaney. There's like everything from ha-ha to mwa-ha to laugh out loud. I didn't realize that laugh out loud or LOL now means I feel nothing. I want this conversation to be over with. What's the broadest thing you can say about how social media has changed everything?
Well, for one thing, it's killed the period, as some might want to argue. I don't think it's killed the period, but it has lessened its importance as end punctuation, because now we can send texts that are one-line messages. We can send direct messages, whether that is over GChat or over Facebook Messenger or as a tweet or wherever you are sending your one-line message. Now we don't need that end punctuation. And millennials, you know, as they are wont to do, killing everything from napkins to the diamond industry to cereal and whatever else millennials are killing, they have a tendency, I think, that there have been tons of think pieces already written about this, that the period at the end of a sentence can convey a sort of formality that can come off as aggressive or indicating anger or tension. And it's so wild that the period, which is the building block of our language punctuation-wise, is sort of a loaded punctuation mark now. Also, in tweets, you know, we have a tendency to not use other types of punctuation like commas and not use capitalization at the beginning of a sentence. And sometimes it's deliberate to kind of affect a breezy, aloof kind of tone, especially when it's a kind of weighty statement. There's just a kind of coolness or funniness or whatever the tone you're looking for may be that comes with not punctuating and not correctly capitalizing.
Look, Emmy Favilla, the title of the book is A World Without Whom. For some of us, we think of when John Kerry, the former senator, secretary of state, presidential candidate, was said to have said, whom among us can forget something? And everybody, that immediately telegraphed that he might be something of an elite. Others would say maybe he was just using language correctly. But what do you mean about a world without whom?
whom is an antiquated word. We don't use it in everyday speech, in everyday conversation. I see it going the way of shan't. You know, it's just kind of a word that we are organically using less and less. It doesn't really come naturally in speech. It sort of seems pretentious, overly formal. And the worst is when you use whom incorrectly. And I quote Lisa McClendon, who is a very cool professor, I believe, at the University of Kansas. And she presented a session at a conference where she said, always use who this way. You're not wrong and pretentious. And that really stuck with me. And it struck a chord and was a bit of the influence behind the title of the book. It's an example of the way that our language is changing and something we can kind of let go of without feeling bad about it.
Well, we shan't use whom then. Emmy Favilla, your new book, A World Without Whom, The Essential Guide to Language in the BuzzFeed Age. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
There are new negotiations underway today in Geneva, Switzerland, to try to end the civil war in Syria. It's a conflict that has taken hundreds of thousands of lives since it started in 2011. The government continues to pound rebel-held areas, especially in eastern Damascus, where dozens have been killed in recent airstrikes. Joining us now is the BBC's Imogen Folks. She is in Geneva. And Imogen, is there any reason to think that these new talks will be any different than the previous failed negotiations?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that expectations are not especially high. This is the eighth round of these negotiations. There's been practically no progress so far. But there are a couple of key differences this time. First of all, the Syrian opposition, which was previously fragmented into kind of different groups. There was the High Negotiation Council, your listeners will have heard of that, the HNC, which was kind of the official one, two others, the Moscow Group and the Cairo Group. Now, these guys didn't really speak to each other. Now they're united as one. Strength in togetherness, I think, is what they are thinking. And of course, they are facing a Syrian government team which really thinks it's got most of the cards in its hands. The regime has regained territory, in particular Aleppo, this time last year, with the support of Russia. And day by day, they seem to gain a little bit more territory on the ground. So I think the opposition are thinking, if we're going to get any sort of peace negotiation rather than a de facto surrender, we better get on with it. Remains to be seen whether the Syrian government really think it's worth putting any effort into this.
Is there still much talk about a Syria without Bashar al-Assad, or has he kind of won that fight?
That's a very, very good question. I would suggest he's maybe won it for now, but I think the mid to long term thinking, including, I've heard hints from diplomats who prefer to remain anonymous, but including from Russia, is that Bashar al-Assad, after this seven-year horrendous war, could not ever make a success as the leader of his country in the long term. So while there may be some consideration of letting him stay during a transition period, in the long term, I really get the impression that people are thinking there's going to have to be something different. We know, for example, that the Syrian government team, which arrived in Geneva just in the last few hours, delayed coming here, basically as an insult to the opposition, and then had pretty heavy pressure put on them by the Russians to pack their bags, get on the plane, and get their beep-beeps over to Geneva. Otherwise, there wouldn't be too much support anymore.
And what about Russia and President Vladimir Putin? Does he and does Russia emerge as a winner in these talks as well?
I wonder whether anybody could ever be seen to be a winner after the war we've seen in Syria, because it has been so utterly devastating. I think the Russians would like to be seen as the pragmatic superpower which said, right, this has got to end. How are we going to do it strategically? This, this, and this. And then we make sure they both get to the negotiating table and we get on with it from there. But we're a long way still from peace. And obviously, Russia has geopolitical interests in the region, as does the United States. It's just the United States is not very present anymore in this kind of diplomacy. The Russians would like to be seen as the country that looked at a problem, thought about how it needed to be solved, and then go on with it. They would like to have some standing on the world stage again. And, you know, I would say to listeners in the United States, Vladimir Putin is one thing with all of his record of, you know, cracking down on journalists and human rights groups and so on. And then there are career Russian diplomats who possibly approach things in a different way and are not, you know, it's not that like one side's all bad and the other all good. It's just not like that in these negotiations.
What is the U.S. role in these negotiations?
Well, it hasn't been very much for the last 12 months. You know, I think we've talked about this before. We used to see John Kerry here on a regular basis, burning the midnight oil, talking to Sergei Lavrov, sorting out all sorts of things from the Iran nuclear deal to, of course, these Syria talks. Haven't really seen much under the new administration. But interestingly, what we do see is that Washington have sent a couple of pretty senior State Department officials to be present at this round of talks. So that's an indication, again, that maybe people are thinking something could move here, something could be achieved, and the U.S. doesn't really want to be left out of it.
That's the BBC's Imogen Folks joining us from the talks going on about the civil war in Syria. They're happening in Geneva. Imogen, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.